Thank you, Tom. It is great to be with you guys this morning. And I want to kind of do a little pick up with where Tom was. He gave so much good stuff on Veterans Day. And I want to do some of the same. I want to hit Veterans Day for just a minute because there's a perspective that I find interesting. Of course, Tom mentioned how many have served and how many are still active duty today. 1.2 million have died as a result, about 2% of all military guys. We happen to be an Army family is where we are. So I've had a lot of folks deployed into Afghanistan, Iraq, times of war. And I'm always curious about the anti-war protests that go on. And it's not like anyone I know is pro-war. It's not like we go try to start wars or we like wars or we like fighting wars. So anti-war protests are intriguing to me, particularly the rhetoric that they use. I want to point out two parts that are in this. One is God is love. And because he's love, we won't have any wars. Don't think that works that way, but that's their simplistic view of it. The second is read the Bible. And I think that's a great idea. You ought to read the Bible. And if you read the Bible, you find passages like Isaiah 13:3, where God says, I've commanded my holy ones, I've summoned my warriors, the Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. Doesn't seem to be the message they were trying to communicate, but read the Bible. There's other passages that I would point to in the Bible. 1 Chronicles 5:22, for there fell down many slain because the war was of God. And that kind of theologically weird for them to say that war is of God, particularly specific wars. I would say what happened in World War II, as many folks as we lost, 500,000 American lives, it was a war of God. It was 60 million lives lost total, but it crushed a movement that would have destroyed the world. And so it's, you know, there was sacrifice to be paid, but what it did to save the world and save freedom for the world was significant. And by the way, people say, well, that's Old Testament. How about the New Testament? All right, New Testament. I saw heaven open, behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. Jesus makes war? Only if you read the Bible. So this whole notion that we often have of an anti-military kind of thing is as related to Christianity, it's just not accurate. If you go back and look into the Bible, I'll remind you of Exodus 14, where God performed a miracle to defeat the entire Egyptian army. So God weighed in. That wasn't Moses that won that battle. That was God that won that battle. If you look at what happened in Exodus 17, where Moses is fighting the Amalekites, as long as Aaron and Hur could keep his arms held in the air, they prevailed over the Amalekites. That wasn't a Moses thing. That was a God thing. God's the one who weighed in on that and used Moses and Aaron and Hur to keep his arms up, and they defeated the Amalekites. If you look at what happened in Joshua 6, the walls came down. Joshua sure didn't knock those walls down. It was not Joshua at all. He obeyed what God said, but God knocked the walls down, defeated the enemy. They went in and completely destroyed the enemy that was there. If you look in Joshua 10, Joshua was fighting the Amorites and said, boy, if I just had some more time, we could crush these guys. And God says, let me just hold the sun still for you. So remember, the Lord held the sun for a day so that Joshua could continue to destroy the Amorites. That's a God thing. That's not a human thing. If God doesn't get involved in military and war, then what are all these accounts about throughout the Bible? And so there is a very clear biblical perspective on war. As a matter of fact, we used to teach what was called just war. We stopped that a few years ago. We're getting back to it now. If you understand just war, it helps a whole lot with being able to handle what we now call PTS. Been all sorts of other names across the wars. But if you understand what's right and wrong when you're fighting from God's perspective, it's really easy to handle conscience and what goes with it when you have to take lives. If you take lives in a just manner, in a biblical manner, you stand clean before God. If you take lives in an unjust manner, as Saul did when he killed the Gibeonites, God brought judgment on the nation because of the way that war was conducted. So you have David conducting war one way, you get good results. You have Saul conducting war a wrong way, you get bad results. Knowing the biblical difference makes all the world, and that's all the difference. And that's why starting from the 3rd century forward in the church, we taught what was called just war theory. Augustine is one of the first to develop that. How do you know what the Bible says is right and wrong when you go to war? And that used to be something we spent a lot of time on as a nation. We don't anymore, and thus we get the anti-war protest. But I'd even take you to Abraham, the father of our faith. We look to him as Christians and Jews as the father of the biblical religion. And you remember his family was attacked, and he got his household together, went back and attacked. got the kings together, five kings against four kings, and went and just absolutely just destroyed them. And so what he did was take the spoils of war, and he came back, and that's when he met with Melchizedek. And he gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the spoils of war. That's where the tithe gets started. I will point out the tithe was started by giving the spoils of war. I mean, we look at the tithe as something very spiritual today, which we should. But its roots go back to a war. I mean, that's where it got started, and we know that Melchizedek is a likeness of Jesus Christ. Many believe that it actually was Jesus in the Old Testament. So all these accounts that we can go to, David and Goliath, certainly God's hand on David, and David's a warrior. And you know, one of the easiest things to point to is just point to Hebrews 11, which is our Faith Hall of Fame. That's where we have the heroes of the Christian faith. And if you look at the latter part of the chapter, if it's gone through so many names, it says, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel." Every one of these guys was a warrior. Everyone is involved in serious wars. "And who through faith subdued kingdoms, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the enemies." So what you've got at the end of our Faith Hall of Fame is look at all these military heroes we've got. And so what we do today with Veterans Day is really a, if you want to say, a head nod to what the Bible teaches. I mean, we just affirm what the Bible teaches. This is the right way to do it. And as long as America can continue to keep a biblical perspective on our wars and what we do and why we do and how we do it, God will continue to bless. You know, we love to sing the song, "God Bless America," but my gosh, give him something to work with. I mean, do it his way, and then he can bless it a whole lot easier. So when you do things God's way, there's a lot of blessings. And on Veterans Day, we look all the way back and celebrate even those from the American Revolution. 25,000 lives lost there. You go to the Barbary Powers War, 32-year war we fought against the Muslim terrorists and all the lives that were lost there. You go to the War of 1812. I mean, we've had wars every 15 to 20 years in America, and there's been a lot of folks who stepped up to protect our freedom from those who want to take it away. So what we've got is a real blessing in America. It's good to remember that. And I want to talk a little bit this morning about the story of America. And in talking about the story of America, it's going to be the story of the Bible, no question about it. Everything significant that we can point to, even in military circles, go around the Bible and Bible's teachings. I want to take you back to 1607 because that's the first permanent settlement that came to America. They landed there at Cape Henry, and the first thing they did was kneel down, erect a cross, take the scriptures out, have a time of prayer and worship. So from the very beginning, the first feet that set foot on this turf from any European country, we dedicated it to God. We wanted God to be prevalent here. The next major group that comes is in 1620. It's the Pilgrims. And the Pilgrims land there on Plymouth Rock. And you see them stepping out on Plymouth Rock. Well, it's interesting. In the U.S. Capitol, we have a painting of the Pilgrims. It's 14 feet high. It's 20 feet wide. It's much, much larger than everything you see up here. It is a life-size painting of the Pilgrims. And the biggest thing in that painting is the Bible. They're all gathered around the Bible. That was their book. They used it to live from. That's what they used to build their economic system. That's what they used to build their education system. That's what they used to build their governmental system. I mean, they're doing things that had not been done in 1,000 years in civilized society. And they keep reading that book, say, "Oh, we need to do this." And that's why they were such a great model. 10 years later came what was called the Great Puritan Exodus, where you had just thousands of people that came out of England, the Puritans. They had tried to purify the corrupt church, and the corrupt church ended up taking 20,000 of them and cutting their ears off, slicing their nose, and chopping their tongue, and say, "Let's hear you criticize us now." And so at that point, 20,000 came to America eventually in that great Puritan Exodus. But it's interesting that when you look at pictures of them, what do you see prominent? Bible. Everybody's got a Bible. I mean, that was the book. This is the thing that made America different. When people came here to live out what the Bible said, because it was not being done in Europe. They're living by traditions that were not biblical. And when these people would point them out, they again got their nose slit, ears chopped off, and tongues sliced. So you go all the way through all the different colonies, and you finally get to the final colony in America, which is 1732. Georgia was the last colony founded. It was founded by Christians, and actually, the three people they had as chaplains of the colony were John and Charles Wesley and George Whitefield. So when that's the chaplains for your colony, you can imagine, you know, what that colony is going to be like. So we have all of those years, about 125 years of settlements before we finally get the 13 colonies built. And at about that time that we get that final colony built, And we have this chaplain in America, Georgia chaplain named George Whitfield. It's the same time that we start moving in what's called the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening was a revival. It's a massive revival that went on for 40 years, 1730 to 1770. That's the interesting thing about revivals in America. You know, we talk about having a revival in the church. We have a weekend meeting, and that's not really a revival. A revival spans decades, literally. You look at the revivals of Asa or Jehoshaphat or Josiah in the Bible. They're all transgenerational revivals. They span literally one, two, three generations. So revivals are more like reformation. If you think of reformation, that's really what a biblical revival looks like. And so it was a 40-year period of time, and it's interesting that Whitfield being the center of that, and he wasn't the only guy. You had the Reverend Samuel Davies and Reverend Gilbert Tennant, and you had Jonathan Mayhew and Samuel Cooper and all these preachers all over America. But Whitfield's the guy we really look at and the guy we really see. Whitfield, interesting thing about Whitfield was Whitfield, in his time in America, he spent 34 years here. And he rode across America on horseback. He made seven journeys from Maine to Georgia and back on horseback, preaching everywhere he could along the way, going different routes. He carried a pulpit on the back of his horse, and he'd pull into a town, untie the pulpit, set it up, get up and preach, tie it back on the horse, go to the next town. So over a period of 34 years, he preached 18,000 sermons. Now, you know, I'm a cowboy. I do horseback. And I've been in all kinds of weather, but I can't imagine living 34 years essentially in that kind of weather. You know, I keep a duster with me, and it gets cold, and I've been snowed on. I've had hail pound me, and I've had thunderstorms and everything else. Whitfield, this is what he did for 34 years essentially, was live outside, live outdoors, preaching everywhere, everyone, wherever he went. Do you know it's estimated that 80% of all Americans physically heard him preach a sermon? Do you know how many communities you have to be in? For 80% of Americans, think what it would take to just go across Kentucky. How many communities would you have to touch in Kentucky for 80% of Kentuckians to hear you physically preach something? So Whitfield, what he did was just unprecedented. It actually killed him. Anybody that thinks revivals are fun, they're not. They're a lot of work. Whitfield, the last 2 years of his life, after he would preach, he'd go off the side and spit up blood and just cough up his guts and then get back on his horse and go to the next place and preach. He never knew he was in a revival. Historians 20 years later said, we think that was a revival. Let's call it the First Great Awakening. What he did was a lot of hard work. Nonetheless, Whitfield and all this revival stuff that he did, he had a famous sermon that he preached all over America. It's called the Father Abraham Sermon. We know about it because so many of the founding fathers heard him preach that sermon. I mean, you've got Ben Franklin, and you got John Adams, and you got Thomas Jefferson all talk about the sermon. John Adams writes a letter to Jefferson. He said, I've heard him give this sermon so many times. He says, I can see him every time. He says, he stands there in his black robe with his hands raised to the air, and you kind of see that over on the side, the hands raised to the air. And Whitfield says, I had a vision last night. He says, I went to bed, and I had a vision, and in this vision, I dreamed that I had arrived at the gates of heaven. And when I arrived at the gates of heaven, Peter was there to meet me. And when I saw Peter, I was so elated, and being a Methodist and helping found Methodist churches all over America, I was so elated and said, Peter, I can't wait to see my Methodist brethren. And Peter said, bad news, no Methodist made it. No Methodist made it to heaven? Well, I've got a lot of Baptist friends, so I get to see them. No Baptist made it. And he went through every denomination and said, Peter, who do you have here? And the answer was, he quoted Acts 10:35. He said, all that we have here are those that fear God and worketh righteousness. They're the ones accepted of him. And so what he was saying at the time was, it's not the denomination you're from. It's your beliefs and your relationship with Christ. And you see, that was significant because in America, with those 13 colonies, we had 9 different state-established churches there. And if you're in Virginia, for example, the state-established church is the Anglican Church. And the Anglican Christians in Virginia killed Quakers, they imprisoned Baptists, they fined Methodists, they imprisoned Presbyterians. If you're the wrong denomination, we as Christians are willing to kill you. Really? See, that's what America was in those early days. And Whitfield comes along and says, God doesn't care about denominations. He cares about whether you're in right relationship with him. And so that was what he preached for those 40 years across America. Now, the Great Awakening comes to an end in about 1770. That's when Whitfield died in 1770. He's buried at a church in Newburyport, Massachusetts. So the Great Awakening comes to an end, and it's interesting that about that period of time, we've got all these tensions that are going on across America. We've got the stuff with the Stamp Act that's been going since 1765, and 1767 we get the Townshend Acts and the Intolerable Acts, and Great Britain is just starting to crack down on America. I mean, just really whacking us hard. And so after several years of that, we decide we need to get together and see what we're going to do as a people, and that's our first Continental Congress. So these guys that get together on that day, they had never met each other. I mean, you're 13 colonies, and you need to think of the colonies more like independent nations. You know, France and Poland do not get along with each other at all. When they tried to do a European constitution 5 years ago, France said, if it has the word God in the constitution, we're not going to be part of it. And Poland said, if it doesn't have the word God in the constitution, we're not going to be part of it. And so you've got a really secular nation, a very Christian nation. And that's kind of, although it's not a perfect example for America, because all of our nations, all of our states were Christian, they acted like nations. They acted independently. If you went from North Carolina to South Carolina, you had to stop at the border and change money to go from one state to another. Every state had their own money. So when these guys get together, it's more like the guys from Massachusetts don't know anything about the guys from Virginia. And the guys from New York have never met the guys from Georgia because they're all different nations. So they get together trying to figure out what to do with all this British stuff that's coming against them. And it's interesting. John Adams records what they did. John Adams wrote numerous letters to his wife Abigail. One of the most fun books to read is just the letters of John Adams to his wife Abigail, because he tells her what's happening every day, what they're thinking is, what's going on. And he told Abigail what happened when they first got together. It was September the 6th of 1774. He said, Abigail, he said, when the Congress first met, Mr. Thomas Cushing of Massachusetts made a motion that it should be opened with prayer. It's a good thing to do. Start a political gathering with prayer. He continued, he says, it was opposed by Mr. John Jay of New York and Mr. John Rutledge of South Carolina. They didn't want to pray. Now, that seems strange, because John Jay of New York is one of the most outspoken Christians in America. He's a founder of the American Bible Society. He is a theologian, and he doesn't want to pray. You know, and the same with John Rutledge out of South Carolina. He doesn't want to pray. Here's why. Because we were so divided in religious sentiments. We're some Episcopalians, some Quakers, some Anabaptists, some Presbyterians, some Congregationalists, that we could not join in the same act of worship. See, this is the stuff that Whitfield's been talking about for all these years, and this is the division that divides America. You're a Presbyterian. I'm a Baptist. I can't pray with you. So this is the way America was at that point in time. And then John Adams says, but it changed because Sam Adams stood up and said something. Sam Adams stood up and he said, he rose and said, I'm no bigot. I can listen to a prayer from a gentleman of piety and virtue who's at the same time a friend. I don't care what denomination you are. If you love God and you love America, I'll listen to you pray. I don't have any trouble with that. And so what happened when Sam said that, they all go back and go, oh yeah, Father Abraham's sermon. That's what we've been hearing for the last 40 years. This is the Father Abraham moment. And so what happened at that point in time was it changed things. Now, let me kind of show you the perspective. This is what happened after they started praying. This is a painting that was done of the first prayer in Congress, because so many of these guys wrote about what happened there. And the guy who started this off was, here's the guy who made the motion. Cushing of Massachusetts said, let's pray. And it was opposed by Rutledge of South Carolina, and it was opposed by John Jay of New York. And they said, we can't do that. And that's when Sam Adams said, well, I can. I'll listen to anybody who loves God and loves his country. I'll point out that it kind of broke the logjam. This prayer meeting lasted for 2 hours. Once they almost didn't get it done, and then they start praying, and they pray for 2 hours. And by the way, Sam Adams does something really remarkable. He's a Congregationalist from Massachusetts. If the Congregationalists had any religious enemies at all, it is the Anglicans. Because the Anglicans, that's what Great Britain is, and they're trying to establish an Anglican national church in all of America. They want every American to be an Anglican. And so Sam Adams says, you know, as a matter of fact, I know an Anglican guy across town. We ought to have the Anglican come pray over here. Now, that's really crossing the lines, because Sam is a Congregationalist, and they dislike Anglicans immensely. And so Reverend Jacob Duchesne came and led prayers, and then after praying, and 2 hours of prayer, they also covered 4 chapters of the Bible that morning. They went through the Bible, had Bible studies together. And so John wrote Abigail after it was all over. And this is John, by the way. He's there for all this stuff. So we know a lot about this because of what he wrote. He told Abigail, he said, Abigail, I must beg you to read that psalm. What psalm? read the 35th Psalm to your friends, or read to your father. He told Abigail that as he was going through the Psalms that morning, we were on Psalm 35, and that seemed like God had written it for this very day. Now, they used the Book of Common Prayer. The Book of Common Prayer, that version had been done about 200 years earlier, and it tells you what chapters to study on which day. It's kind of like a systematic Bible study. Here's what you do today and tomorrow. And so on that very day, Psalm 35 is the psalm they're supposed to cover. And Psalm 35, if you read Psalm 35 and realize that what they had heard on that day was Boston is now under attack by the British, we haven't separated from Great Britain, we don't have an army, we don't have a navy, we get nothing but a bunch of school teachers and shopkeepers and farmers, and we got the greatest army in the world attacking us, we don't know what to do. And Psalm 35 dealt exactly with that issue. He said, Abigail, God knew exactly what was going to happen today. Hundreds of years ago, he had Psalm 35 set apart for today, and that's what we read this morning, and it's exactly what we needed. And so he said, I want you to read it. He said, I want you to read it to your friends. I want you to read it to your father. Her father was the pastor of their church, the Reverend William Smith. He said, you got to let everybody know what God showed us this morning out of Psalm 35. So that's the first prayer in Congress, and then from that we find a unity, we get together, the Father Abraham thing does happen, we start working together, and in 1776 we get to the Declaration of Independence, sign that declaration. Now, when we did that, that now meant we are officially separated from Great Britain, and the problem is we don't have any national government at this point. We don't have anything except a desire not to be under oppression, so we don't have a way to, for example, take care of commerce. Everything that we had coming in came from Great Britain. That was our trading partner. That was our shipping partner. We were British colonies, British citizens. Everything came from Great Britain. Now we're at war, and they have blockaded all of our ports. They blockaded Boston. They blockaded Charleston. They blockaded Richmond. They blockaded everything. We can't get ships. We can't get supplies in and out, and that's part of Great Britain's plan, is starve these guys into submission. And so what happens is, as we go across and we have all these battles in the first year and a half, you got Lexington, you got Concord and Monmouth and Saratoga and Bunker Hill and all these battles. We're fighting all these battles with our trading partner, and we find out we have a shortage. And the shortage that we have is of Bibles. We can't get Bibles in anymore. And America can't exist without Bibles. It's interesting to see what Congress does in 1777. 1777, Congress says the use of the Bible is so universal and its importance is so great, the Congress will order the Committee of Commerce to import 20,000 Bibles from Holland or Scotland or anywhere we can get them into the different ports of the states of the United States. We got to get Bibles coming into America. It's interesting, in the middle of the war, Congress is concerned about we don't have enough Bibles. And of all the things you could worry about, we don't have enough bullets, we don't have enough ammunition, we don't have enough food. No, we don't have enough Bibles. And so Congress actually moved that we get more Bibles in. And so then there was a plan proposed that says, well, you know, importing them is going to be kind of tough because we're at war and they've got our ports blockaded. What if we just print them here? What if we do it here? And it's interesting, in 1781, that's the final battle of the American Revolution, the Battle of Yorktown, where the British lay down their arms. And as a result of what the British did and surrendering there, for the first time in literally 150 years, it doesn't matter what any British king tells us anymore. King George III, he's irrelevant. We don't care. The reason that's significant is way back at the founding of America, the British passed a law that says if you're a British colony, you can't print any Bible in the English language. You have to get the Bible the Crown tells you to use. Robert Barker was the printer for the Crown, and he's going to tell you what Bible to use, and the king will tell him what Bible to print. And that's, so if the king's Anglican, we'll be Anglican. If he's Catholic, we'll be Catholic. We were not able to print Bibles in America at all under British law. We couldn't do that. Now, we printed Bibles in other languages. The first Bible ever used in America was 1661. It was done by John Eliot, the apostle of the Indians in Massachusetts, but it was done in the Algonquin, or the Massachusetts Indian language. We printed Bibles in Massachusetts and in Cherokee and in Shawnee and Ojibwe. We printed them in French and Italian and Russian and Latin and Greek, everything except English. But now we have whipped the British, and it doesn't matter what their laws say anymore. And so it's striking that at that point in time, after we did that, there was a proposal made to Congress that we do something. And they printed the first Bible. The first Bible ever printed in English in America was 1782. And it was printed by a guy named Robert Aiken. If you can see the name there, Robert Aiken is the official printer of Congress. He does all congressional printing. And so the first Bible that came out, 1782, it's interesting that in the front of that Bible, you find there, for example, the congressional committees that were in charge of overseeing this. You find the chaplains who have read the Bible to make sure it's accurate. No words were changed. This is God's word. We didn't make anything up. We checked it for accuracy. And it actually has a congressional endorsement there at the bottom. It says, resolved that the Congress, United States and Congress assembled recommend this edition of the Bible to the inhabitants of the United States. So here's Congress. The first Bible printed in America is done by the printer of Congress, and it has a congressional endorsement in front. Why in the world would we have done that? And it's interesting that when Aiken explained to Congress, he told Congress what this is going to be for. He said, quote, he said, this is a neat addition of the Holy Scriptures for the use of our schools, end quote. And by the way, here's the actual handwritten document where he says that. And Congress said, right on, exactly, that's what we want. And so that's how this Bible came to be. The first Bible ever printed in English in America, printed because we won the war, because Congress said, yep, we need a Bible for our schools, and this is going to be a perfect edition of the Bible for our schools. So that's 1782, and 1783 is when we signed the peace treaty in the American Revolution. Standing there on the left is John Jay, and seated in the center is John Adams, and on the right is Ben Franklin. And these guys signed the peace treaty, and it is, you can see it at the State Department, the sixth floor of the State Department, the John Quincy Adams State Drawing Room. It's right there. The signatures, there's four signatures on the left. David Hartley is the British ambassador. He's up top. And then John Adams, Ben Franklin, and John Jay. But it's interesting, the title they put on the treaty. The title of the treaty is, In the Name of the Most Holy and Undivided Trinity. Now, it's interesting that that's what we said to end. We start this thing with prayer and Bible. We then print a Bible once we're free, and then we say, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you see the thinking here? Now, you guys, every one of you did see these documents when you went through history class in school, right? Everybody got that? Oh, no, I don't think we cover this anymore. See, it's interesting how we have so secularized our own history when there are so many actual documents, key documents. This isn't just a letter from between two individuals in the Revolution. We're talking the official document that made us the nation. We do it in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So it's interesting that John Adams, it was very easy for him to say what he said. He said the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Well, once we have achieved independence, now we have to create a national government, which is where we get into the Constitutional Convention. At the Constitutional Convention, we need to come up with something. And for those for those of you that might have been there on Friday night, forgive me, I'm going to share some of the same content for a minute here on that, because I want you to see the speech that Ben Franklin gave. Franklin had been pushing for America to become the United States of America for 33 years. He's the first guy to ever push that. It took 33 years before it happened. And at the Constitutional Convention, he's there at the convention, and he is the guy there with the white hair in the center. He's 81 years old at a time when the average lifespan in America back then was 33 years old. I mean, he's a really old guy compared to what the lifespan is. And he's watched as the Constitutional Convention is falling apart. They've been together for 5 weeks, and they haven't agreed on anything yet. And delegates are so disgusted, they're leaving and going home. The convention literally is falling apart. It was at that point in time that he gave the longest speech he gave at the convention. It was unusual because every other speech he had given, he had written out ahead of time and had someone younger read it. But this one came from the heart, and he addressed them from the heart. This is the only speech he gave at the convention where he spoke. Everything else was written. So in this is what he told the other delegates. He said, gentlemen, he said, in this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, as it happens, sir, that we've not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of lights to illuminate our understanding. He said, why haven't we asked God? We've done everything else. We've checked our own wisdom. He says, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. And this is the room in which they signed the Declaration, the room where Continental Congress met. It's the room where they prayed all the time. By the way, Congress back then did not have a House and a Senate. It just had one body. It was a unicameral body, kind of like Nebraska is today. They had three chaplains in that body. They did a lot of praying. As a matter of fact, you'll find that by 1815, they had issued 1,400 government-issued calls to prayer in America by 1815. So a lot of praying going on. Franklin says, guys, don't you remember what we used to do in this room? We prayed all the time. He said, our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. He said, all of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of sovereignty and providence in our favor. I mean, think how many prayers we saw answered. Think how many times God got involved. He said, and have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? He said, I've lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. He said, if a sparrow can't fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. He said, I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we should succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel, and we should become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. He says, I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. Now, what happened as a result of that call to prayer, we covered some on Friday night, but here's the question I asked Friday night, and I'm going to ask again now. 14 sentences in that speech that he spoke. This was just off the heart. It was not written out. This was just out of his mouth. This was just extemporary speech. How many Bible verses did he quote? And the answer is 14. He quoted 14 Bible verses. These are the 14 Bible verses that he quoted. I will point out that a lot of these are what we would consider to be obscure Bible verses. You know, most of you can't look up there and tell me what Job 12:25 says or what James 1:17 says or what Matthew. These are the verses he quoted. Now, these are not the John 3:16 kind of verses that we all memorize. These are verses. So the question becomes, how did Franklin do that? Off the top of the head speech. And he's the least religious founding father. I think out of the 56 guys who signed the Declaration, I think he's one of two guys who was not a Christian. So he's not a Christian founding father. I think he thought he was, nonetheless. And only God knows whether he was or not. You know, I'm not the one who judges eternity. But based on what he said in the last 4 months of his life, he said, I don't think Jesus is divine, but I've never studied it. But at my age, I'm going to know one way or the other pretty soon. And that was the last comment he made. And so, you know, that was the comment he told Ezra Stiles before he died. And so based on that, I'd say, I don't think so. But I don't know what happened in the last 4 months of his life. But nonetheless, he's still one of our least religious founding fathers. And he's quoting verses like that. How did he do that? Now, Jesus gave us the answer to how he did that. Jesus gave us the answer in Matthew 12. Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. What came out of Franklin's mouth was what was in Franklin's heart. What was in Franklin's heart was a whole lot of Bible verses that a lot of us don't even study or read anymore. And he's the least religious founding father. See, out of the abundance of the heart, see, it came out of his mouth because that's what he had planted in his heart. That's the same with any person. What comes out of your mouth is what's in your, I don't know where that came from. I do. It came out of your heart. You just need to check your heart and see what's there. So the language that comes out, whether it's good or bad, whether it's blessing or cursing, as we're told over in James, it all comes from what's in the heart. Now, that means he was doing some serious Bible memorization to be able to roll verses like that out of his mouth. Here's a guy that, again, I don't think was a Christian, but look at the Bible memorization he had been doing. That means look at the Bible reading he had been doing to be able to memorize the Bible so that when he got to this point of frustration, I'm so ticked you guys can't get along with each other. I'm so upset over you guys all leaving town because you're tired of fighting. It's what came out of his mouth. This is his frustration speech, if you will. And look what it was. It was all Bible verses. Let me give you a couple more examples. We know of Patrick Henry's famous speech on Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death. He did that speech on March 23rd, 1775. I want to read part of that speech to you. And again, this was a frustration speech for Patrick Henry, by the way. The assembly there in Virginia, there were a whole lot of loyalists in it, and the loyalists are saying, we do whatever the king says. Well, what if the king's wrong? Well, he's the king. We just do what the king says. And Patrick Henry is so frustrated at that mentality. And they say, and by the way, even if we think the king's wrong, we're too weak to do anything. We don't have a military. We don't have an army. We don't have any. And so here's another frustration kind of speech from a founding father. Patrick Henry said, sir, we're not weak. If we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature has placed in our power, the millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess, they're invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. And he said, besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It's to the vigilant, the active, and the brave. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. By the way, he turns out to be a prophet. The next clash, the next report they got from the north was Battle of Lexington, Concord, and Boston Road happened. See, this is on March the 23rd. It's on April the 19th, which is about 3.5 weeks later, that all those battles occur. And he said it's going to come from the north. The next gale that comes from the north is going to have on the sound of have on its edge this clash of resounding arms. And he was exactly right. He said, our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? He said, gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. Now, that's part of his famous speech, and kind of like the speech with Franklin, that's 14 sentences long. Question is, what Bible verses, how many did he quote? In that speech, he quoted 11 Bible verses. Now, these are the Bible verses he quoted, and this is another one of those frustration speeches where it just flowed out from inside him. What flowed out from inside him? Bible verse after Bible verse after Bible verse after Bible verse. This is what he's been memorizing. This is what he's hidden in his heart. Psalm 119, that word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee. So this is what these guys were putting into their heart. If you look even at George Washington, when George Washington was inaugurated president of the United States, we had 13 colonies. Now we're starting to think of ourselves as a nation. He says, you know, it'd be really good if I traveled among the colonies and went and visited them, because we need to all think like a nation. And so as he's going into Rhode Island, he was planning to go into Rhode Island in 1790. And as he did, there was a congregation in Rhode Island, a Hebrew congregation, who heard that George Washington's coming. And they wrote, the Hebrew congregation at Newport wrote George Washington a letter, said, man, God has raised you up for this time. You are such a blessing. What you've done to protect religious liberties and freedom for all of us. And so it's just a gushing letter thanking George Washington for who he is and what he does. And Washington wrote back to them his own letter. The letter he wrote back, very, very short. It's kind of like a presidential letter. Here's the letter he wrote back. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. He said, may the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness in our paths, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy. That's two sentences. So here's the question. Two sentences. How many Bible verses were quoted? 10 Bible verses in those two sentences. That letter is nothing but Bible verse after Bible verse. These are the Bible verses he quoted. Most of them are from the Old Testament because he's writing to a Hebrew congregation. And by the way, that phrase that everyone should sit in safety in his own vine and fig tree, Washington loved that phrase. That was his John 3:16. He quoted that phrase over 30 times in his writings and letters. Now, most of us don't even know where that phrase came from or what it meant or why the prophet said that phrase or what it indicated at the time. But these are our political, I'm not talking pastors here. I'm talking political leaders that are doing this kind of stuff, which tells you the climate of America, that we hid God's word in our heart. That's just part of what we did. So when you look at all these guys and the speeches, it's all out of the abundance of the heart. All these speeches are given. It's all about Bible memorization. I'm going to show you why we did this. I'm going to take you back to schools in America. Matter of fact, let me take you to Thomas Jefferson. He's the other least religious founding father. I'd put Jefferson and Franklin and Thomas Paine is probably the top three guys. Thomas Paine, definitely far away, the most anti-religious. Ben Franklin and Jefferson weren't anti-religious. They were least religious. But when Jefferson becomes president of the United States, according to the Constitution, Washington, D.C. cannot be a state ever. We'll have to amend the Constitution for them to be a state. And so what happens is the federal government runs the city of Washington, D.C. That's why when Washington, D.C. 3 years ago said, we want to do physician-assisted suicides, Congress said, well, we don't, and you can't do it. Congress literally is the local city council for all of Washington, D.C. There's no policy that can come through D.C. that does not get passed by Congress. Now, what Congress did in the 60s was they allowed Washington, D.C. to set up their own local elections, have a mayor and city council, etc., but everything is still subject to the approval of Congress. So when Jefferson becomes president of the United States, he's now also the mayor of Washington, D.C. He's now also over the school district in Washington, D.C. And so he was president of the school board in Washington, D.C., which imagine that. You know, you can imagine Trump being the president of the school board in Washington, D.C., while he's president of the United States. I mean, that doesn't seem right to us today, but that's what Jefferson was. And so the Washington, when Jefferson became president, he's the first president to have a full term in Washington, D.C. So they're just starting the Washington, D.C. public schools. And so he's on the school board. He decided not to be president. He said, I'm president of the United States and kind of busy. I'll be on the school board, but I'm not going to be president of the school board. So he's on the school board. He wrote the actual plan of education for Washington, D.C. public schools, their original plan of education. The year after they get it started, they have annual reports to say how the kids are doing in school. I want you to see what's happening in the schools of Washington, D.C. on the plan of education started by Thomas Jefferson. It said, this is the report from the school board. 55 students have learned to read in the Old and New Testaments and are all able to spell words of 3, 4, and 5 syllables. 26 are now learning to read Dr. Watts' hymns and spell words of 2 syllables. And then on top of that, of 59 that did not know a single letter, they couldn't read at all, 20 can now read the Bible and they can spell words of 3, 4, and 5 syllables. 29 can now read Dr. Watts' hymns. They can spell words of 2 syllables. And 10 can spell words of 4 and 5 letters. So we're talking first and second grade. How are they learning to read out of the Bible? What are they learning? They're reading the Bible and Watts' hymns. Now, you know, the thing about the Bible I get, but what's this Dr. Watts' hymns thing? Dr. Watts is the greatest, considered one of the greatest hymn writers in American in Christian history. This is his hymn book. We have one of his hymn books from 1719, but he's the guy who wrote all sorts of hymns we would recognize. Am I a soldier of the cross? Jesus shall reign. Oh, God, our help in ages past. Joy to the world at the cross when I surveyed. You see, hymn books back then had no music in them. They were only the words. You had a cantor that sang the melody, and you would repeat the melody. So when you're reading Isaac Watts' hymn book, you're reading something like the Bible, essentially. What you're reading is all these Christian hymns that this guy wrote. And by the way, he set the entire 150 Psalms to music, and he did it in 3 ways. We're told in 1 Corinthians, you sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. He set the Psalms to music exactly the way the Psalms are written. Then you had Psalms and hymns, and then he gave them a loose translation. That's kind of version 2. And then a spiritual song, it's kind of like using the Message Bible or the Living Bible today. He wrote every psalm in 3 versions, psalm, hymn, and spiritual song. And this is what the kids are reading. It's kind of like reading the psalms out of the King James and reading the psalms out of the NIV and reading the psalms out of the Message verses. And that's what the kids are learning to read from? Yeah. And who set that up? Thomas Jefferson set that up. So from the very beginning, we're learning the Bible. We're learning to read from the Bible. It's done by Jefferson. I want to show you how that continued throughout education in America. I'm going to take you to 1816, the New Jersey public schools. This is the report of the public schools in New Jersey in 1816. It says, all the scholars of the first and second classes commit to memory portions in the New Testament or Psalms, a lesson of the catechism, several hymns, and the text of the preceding Sabbath. So everybody in school is learning to memorize the scriptures and the catechism, and the psalms, and the hymns, and whatever verses were used in the pulpit on the previous Sunday. We're public school and we're memorizing that every week? Yeah, we do serious Bible memory every week. It continues. It says, one of the scholars has committed to memory the book of John. Now, we're talking first and second grades here. You saw we were first and second grade. One of the scholars committed to memory the book of John, the first 30 psalms, together with the 119th psalm. When's the last time you memorized the 119th Psalm? First graders, the majority have committed the gospel by John. Wait a minute, the majority of first graders have memorized the book of John? Let's continue. It says, in the third and fourth grades, one of the scholars of these classes committed to memory the Westminster Larger Catechism. That is a huge theological book. To the commandments, Christ's Sermon on the Mount, and 10 chapters in John. Well, let's jump from New Jersey. Let's jump to the end of the century. Let's go to Pennsylvania in 1892. Here's what they're memorizing in Pennsylvania schools. Pennsylvania schools says, let the selections for the week be, these are memorized sections, let the selections for the week be, if possible, 2 in number. The first from the Bible or sacred song, the second from the world of literature, prose, or verse. Say, for example, let's memorize the 90th Psalm and Lincoln's speech at Gettysburg. That's 1 week memorization work, okay? Kids are memorizing something every week. 1 week we're going to memorize the 90th Psalm and Lincoln's speech at Gettysburg, or we could memorize Lead Kindly Lad and Longfellow's Psalm of Life, Or we could memorize the 23rd Psalm and lulls once to every man or nations. Or we could memorize the 19th Psalm and home sweet home. Or we could memorize My Country Tis of Thee of the Chambered Nautilus, or the 13th chapter of Romans and the Last Rose of Summer. Or we could do any of the other hundreds of good things, moral, religious, patriotic, descriptive, or sentimental, in the best sense of the word, that we should all be very glad to have securely lodged in the memory, and let the teacher always commit to memory what is here required of the pupil.